Hey everyone, this is Adriana, producer of The Skill Set. I just wanted to let you know that a new episode of The Skill Set is live, and you can listen anywhere you download your podcast. This new episode is with Solomon Renfro, a talented sneaker designer at New Balance, who shares his unique journey from studying interior architecture to becoming a footwear visionary. You don't want to miss this conversation.
Welcome to the Imagine Place podcast. I'm your host, Doug Shapiro, and I'm searching for voices that can help inspire a more creative and courageous you. All right, settle in. I've got a good one today. I have the well-known and loved designer, Joey Shimoda. He reflects on his childhood growing up in Dothan, Alabama in the 1960s. Pretty wild childhood, and only one of two Asian families in his neighborhood. Joey's story and this whole conversation is a testament to the power of curiosity and open-mindedness. We'll talk about the potential impacts of emerging tech like AI and the metaverse and how that will impact design. And we also take time to celebrate the enduring importance of craft and all the weirdness that is humanity. Well, you've given me some good prep, so I'm excited to excited to dig into that. I couldn't believe I saw you were born in Alabama in the mid-60s.
Yeah.
What a hotbed of change that was happening right there.
Yeah, the story is an interesting story because it has to do, unfortunately, with a lot of bad parts of American history. My dad's family was interned in Manzanar during World War II. And so after the war, the brothers and my grandfather, they migrated to Washington, D.C. with the thought that moving closer to the government would and farther away from the ocean would help not get them in trouble again and be put into a camp. One brother did stay in D.C., and he was the first in our family, I think, to really go to university. He worked for the Navy as an acoustic engineer, which was for submarines, which was pretty obscure.
Wow, yeah.
But everybody else, because agriculture was primarily what they did, my family had a supermarket in San Bernardino before they were interned. And they migrated south. They could have gone another hour and hit the water again and been in the, you know, the panhandle of Florida, but they stopped at the corner where Georgia, Florida, and Alabama meet at a place called Dothan. And at that time, they were doing lots of agriculture work, mostly in chickens. And so I was born in Dothan, Alabama in 1965.
Wow.
Yeah. Kind of a crazy time.
Oh my gosh. Yeah.
You know, we were one of two Asian families in the community, a small community. And so, you know, I got to experience the best and the worst of that environment for that time period, for sure.
When you say the worst, it's pretty obvious. I mean, what what you went up against, and we can get into that. But when you say the best, are you meaning the sort of public resistance and public effort to make change?
Yeah.
I mean, is that what you're referring to?
I think as a young person, I was so immersed in the sort of, and using community is even the wrong word, in a world that was very, very determined to impose its thoughts on everyone else, right? So racism was incredibly, incredibly steeped in the culture. Segregation was still, you know, I would imagine that if I was born a couple years earlier, the signs would have still been up, you know, whites only, blacks only. And so that environment did not change. You know, it was really obvious to me, every aspect, you know, where people lived, where they went to school, what jobs they had. So I saw that from a very, very early age. I think that was pretty great because it gave me a perspective about humanity that I don't think I would have had if I grew up someplace else.
Yeah.
But I can say when I was 4 years old, I pretty much knew I wasn't in the right place. And so I was always looking outward.
I can imagine that feeling always being there. I want to imagine it. I can't. I've never been in those shoes, but I can imagine how difficult that must have been. especially, you know, where do you find yourself? Where do you find your own identity in this? And like you said, if there was only one other Asian family, how do you begin to associate yourself with something bigger, which is important as a kid?
Yeah. Well, yeah, you know, I think there were two things that were probably really distinctive and how that helped me. The first one was because my uncle had a egg farm that provided eggs to the majority of the community. So to the military base and to the, you know, all the grocery stores. So our name was on the egg boxes and egg trucks. So there was a relationship because most people would buy those eggs. And so they knew the name. They knew there was something behind it and it wasn't just a person or people. So that was a very big deal. The other thing was that, you know, at that time, Bruce Lee was a really big deal. Like his, you know, and in the African American community, it was a huge deal. Yeah. And so they associated me with Bruce Lee, and they would ask me if I knew Kung Fu and things like that. And eventually I would just say yes, right? Because it kept me out of trouble. But there were, you know, so that kind of made people interested or wanting to know a little bit about me or my family. I mean, I was by no means, you know, popular or anything like that, but yeah. There was a degree of acceptance in that.
That is not at all what I could have expected you to say. I mean, that's so interesting. Did you find yourself, just out of curiosity, did you find yourself associating more or connecting more with the Black community in Alabama?
A little bit, in some degrees, yeah, because I think definitely looking different allowed me to do that. There was also, you know, when I think about the road from being there and the road to being a designer, and I've been able to kind of look back and go, wow, what were the things that kind of got me there?
Yeah. Right?
And, you know, I think for me, when I was very young, bicycle racing and skateboarding were big things. And it just happened that there were guys in my school, they were Black and they had a half pipe. And so they let me come over and hang out. But I would have to go, you know, ride my bike to these crazy areas of town. And, you know, I wouldn't tell my parents that. But when you're, you know, used to be you just go places when you're after school and nobody knows where you go. So, yeah, so that kind of allowed me to connect with that. But it was also very difficult because in that that kind of place, sports is everything. And football and excelling in sports meant success and it meant acceptance. And I was not good at sports at all. I mean, I was, you know, 75 pounds, just couldn't, you know, they let me kind of play and, you know, stand on the side, but I was never going to be an athlete, not in Alabama.
But they believed that, you know, Kung Fu. So they let you alone.
They let me alone, which I thought was funny. That was really funny. But you know, that was such a surprise to hear something like that.
Yeah. But, oh my gosh. That's just wild, Joey. When did you leave Alabama?
So I left Alabama when I was 13.
Okay.
My parents divorced when I was pretty young. And my mom remarried to a guy that worked for Bechtel. And the headquarters was in San Francisco. And so they moved to Marin County. So I went from Alabama to Marin County.
Oh my gosh.
Which was also a very different kind of experience.
I can't imagine. Wow. What's your first memory of that?
Well, I mean, I think I was really ready to leave Alabama, you know, and so it was very exciting for me to be able to come to see San Francisco for the first time. And you know, when we came to LA, we came through Los Angeles. And so specifically because my brother and I were racing bikes at the time and there was a big race in Southern California. And, you know, my parents agreed, let's stop there and you can go to the race or we can race in it.
Wow. What an adventure.
I kind of maybe want to expand on this because I've been thinking about this a lot because most recently, you know, I thought when I was a kid, I could draw. I was really good at drawing and not so good at painting. But you know, when I got my first camera, I took pictures, and because I was really interested in the world of racing motorcycles and bicycles, and I would go to races, and I'm talking to like 10 or 11 years old, and I would take pictures and I would make drawings, and it was just really fantastic for me. And so my interest in cars and motorcycles has never left. It was my first real ability to be not You know, because those sports are very individual sports as well, and they don't require, you know, superhuman strength, like, or, you know, you don't have to, it's not a big team sport thing. So I was really attracted to it. And what I realized was that I was also really attracted to the design, to the, my sense, you know, I've noticed one thing about architects is they really are shy away from color. But I remember being a kid and just wanting to wear every color possible. I mean, I had like purple Converse sneakers and green sneakers, and everybody was looking at me like, where's this coming from? And I don't know where it was coming from, but it was very attractive to me. And then the relationship of design and performance, you know, design and engineering was also really connected there. And so we would do things at, you know, the 10 or 11 years old where I'm taking apart bicycles and motorcycles and painting them and doing all this stuff. And I realized that I don't know where that interest came from, but it certainly was a natural interest.
That's really interesting. I mean, I kind of, there's a comment you kind of slid past, which was the color comment.
Yeah. I mean,
are you still connected to color that way? Or do you?
Oh yeah. I do love color.
Yeah.
I also have a lot of black clothes too, because sometimes not having to make a decision about color, helps. I think that is something that I really encourage everybody in my studio to be cognizant about and not to be afraid of.
Yeah.
Because it opens up so many more possibilities. I mean, that's why I love interiors. It's so much more inclusive in a lot of ways. It touches people more closely than architecture does. I mean, I love architecture doing it, but the results are a little bit different.
So, yeah. Joey, you held this design career that has spanned analog to digital. I was thinking about that, and I was thinking, was there a BCAD line that happened in your career? And if so, what year would you say that line was?
Yeah, I would think that it was probably in college. So I guess that's the mid-80s when it became, when computers started to become part of the drafting world. And then in my early career, it was really emerging. But for the longest time, even until the early 90s, we were only using the computer for plan drawings. We weren't using computers for everything else. But I think for me, I feel really fortunate that I had a BC, you know, well, I guess it's before computer.
Yeah, before computer.
Yeah. After, you know, I am really, really happy that I had that, because, you know, it's a tool and it's a fantastic tool, but you still need to understand what you're trying to do with the tool. And drawing is so deliberate in the relationship of how you think and how you draw and what you're trying to communicate. I think you learn that you're lousy at it much faster than you do in a computer. You know, and it makes you sharper. It makes you go, gosh, my drawing, you look at your neighbors, that drawing looks beautiful. My drawing looks like, you know, a child drew it without a ruler, you know, and I had a ruler, or it's dirty or something. And so you start realizing the action that you take with your body to make something on a piece of paper is a very different action than working on a keyboard and seeing it on a screen.
Yeah. I can see that. I think that's why I like to cook at the end of my workday. You know, like as soon as I'm done with a full day that's in my office doing office work, like I'm just ready to make something. You know, I just need, I just need to smell something and make something.
Well, that's an incredibly important comment, you know, because I think the way that we are, you know, this maybe goes to sort of design education and just how we interact in general. I think our sort of daily interactions with screens and surfaces that are not real are really going to drive us back to exactly what you're talking about. Like what is real? Because at some point we're at the point where not real is going to be so incredibly saturated and surrealistic and overloading all of your brainwaves that we're going to all have to back off.
Yeah.
And figure out a way to be human.
It's almost like right now we choose when to have an experience like that. Do you wonder if we'll ever have to do the opposite, where will there be so much of that experience that we'll have to choose when to be like human and analog and tangible?
I think so. I mean, even when we think about any kind of spirituality or meditation, even without those things, we had to carve time or make time to make sure that you're, you know, I mean, you know, this notion of your own mental health and emotional health, we're totally responsible for that. You know, I don't think there's going to be an app that's going to do it for us. I mean, there are tons of apps, but does it, everybody use them? No.
Well, okay. So this is, I feel like you're hinting at this change. Do you think there is another BCAD line in front of us, or are we at one now, maybe?
I think there is one. I mean, there'll be another, a big moment of where you'll just have to shut things off. I mean, I'm seeing it right now a little bit in Instagram, where Instagram is becoming all of the aspects of commercial television that were negative before. You know, everything, they're just trying to sell you something. I mean, up until now, it's been a way of self-expression, just like TikTok is, but it has all these different degrees of what people are doing and what they're accomplishing. But I'm finding that that the issue of commerce is becoming so much more obvious that at some point it's going to be like, wow, I'm not even interested in this anymore. You know, I need to find another outlet. I mean, that was what was so great about, you know, design magazines before that were quarterly, or, you know, you would get so much great information that was to some degree selected and curated, and it was meaningful because it wasn't just 10,000 things a second. So I think there will be another big, big moment where we're going to go, wow. And I think it's going to probably be from the kids that are, you know, 9 and 10 years old now, when they're like 18 or something. I think there's going to be another major shift of, you know, rejection of a lot of
sort of like the less is more generation or something. Cause I still feel like we're, it's like, as you were describing this Instagram feed and, you know, like, it's still more and more and more, like, we can fit more into this. We can make more money if we do this. We can do, you know, everything's more right now. Even if we have less stuff, the feeling is still more. We can get more work done. You know, we can all, there's always more. And I feel like you're right. That is an aspect that is ripe for change.
Yeah. Well, we'll have to, or else we'll kind of become not very nice people, I think.
You know, that's interesting that's the outcome. You know what I mean? Like, of all the things you could have said, but that's true. I think that is. That's probably, and that's the one we don't talk about enough. But yeah, you're right.
Yeah.
that's really funny. You've thought a lot about this.
Well, I'm seeing a lot of it too. I'm seeing a lot of just how people are trying to be creative. I'm seeing the bridge between physical and virtual, when we're making a building or making a chair or making a lamp or whatever it is, designing stationery. There's some kind of a distance that happens when you're on a screen, working on a screen, or even on a tablet, that isn't the same. You have to bring it back. You have to make it, and then you can come back. What I love is that these tools allow us to iterate so much faster.
Yeah.
You know, we love making these little objects, and the 3D printer is such a great way of testing these objects and looking at them in 3D. And, you know, it used to be we build models and they took a long time. Now no one will pay us to build a model. It's very rare that happens. But I don't think you can make space without it. You have to kind of constantly go between the real thing, an object, and the virtual thing.
Yeah, I wonder if designers leaving school right now, if that sort of understanding is innate and kind of like part of how they think and work, and they don't need to go through the same sort of evolution maybe that others do.
Yeah.
Or do you feel like we're there? Like that's an understanding, or do you feel like people are still struggling with that gap?
I think they're going to still struggle with the gap because the way things are made, I mean, we are so much faster with creating ideas and creating visions, but we can't keep up with building them.
Hmm.
Because the reality of gravity, the reality of cost, the reality of taste, you know, one of the biggest hurdles we all have as designers is that somebody else is paying for the thing.
Yeah, that's true.
You know, and so they have an opinion about what that thing should look like and what it should do and how much it should cost. And so that bridge between ideas and reality, I mean, it's always been a big bridge, right? I mean, for the longest time, people would watch science fiction, but yet we don't have flying cars and we couldn't fly around on the USS Enterprise. You know, we still don't do that yet, but that's very natural for us to think that's going to happen. You know, the holodeck idea is definitely going to happen. It's already happening. You know, they're making movies that way.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. Bringing people back to life, bringing voices back to life. It's amazing.
And you don't have to be in an environment. The environment could be a virtual environment, and we can create the illusion of reality.
It's a little bit like if a tree falls in the forest and no one's there to hear it, did it fall? And it's like, this is like some weird version of this. It's like, well, did things really happen? If we made them happen virtually, does that count? Does that not count? You know, like, so this physical virtual thing is like, it just feels like it's getting blurrier.
Yeah, I think it is. It is. And I mean, I think that's good that we'll have that, but maybe it's a little bit, I was watching the Oscars and, you know, how the Oppenheimer had won everything. And it was that was a moment that changed the world. Right. And so we've been seeing these moments that are changing the world more and more often, maybe not like in a negative way, but in a way that's going to change the way we relate to each other and behavior. And it's moving so quickly, and everybody understands it's moving quickly. And I don't think that that's necessarily a bad thing. I mean, we spend a lot of time trying to understand how it helps us do our work better.
Yep.
And for me, it's really about getting to more solutions faster. But as I get older, I'm realizing that I don't need to have 30 solutions. I can probably get by with one or two and understand why they are going to really work. But a younger designer needs to go through that. They need to get the miles in to see why things don't work. And, you know, that's the one thing about even small projects, you know, furniture, lighting, you can see right away why it doesn't work. And then everybody you share it with will tell you why it doesn't work. Right. I mean, you as a furniture manufacturer, you know, that process is a never ending dialogue.
Yeah.
You know, there's
a lot of general talk about AI, general understanding. Mm-hmm. And I think, what's missing is maybe some of the practical dialogue around AI. Are you using it now? How are you using different tools and what tools, and are you open to sharing that?
Well, sure, absolutely. And then, you know, I want to kind of go backwards a little bit. Remember maybe 3 years ago when everybody was talking about the metaverse?
Yeah.
And for some
it
reason,
was
now,
the word.
Not a lot of people.
It was crazy. Yeah.
Right? It was nuts. So our studio did a pretty deep dive in understanding all of the different aspects of that. And that was also that time with what were the little tokens that NFTs,
oh, yeah. NFTs.
Non-fungible NFT. Yeah. And so we kind of went through this big process of understanding, like, well, what is the metaverse? Why is it important? And is it really going to be this thing where it's an alternate reality? And the answer is it was and will be an alternate reality, but it won't be the kind of thing that we thought it was going to be. What I came to the conclusion was it was all about commerce. Because whatever platform you were in, somebody was a landlord and you were trying to buy space in their space and do something in that space. So that immediately, at that point, I went, oh, well, that's not going to go very far, because what will happen is everybody's just going to want to own their metaverse.
Yeah.
Don't have any competition in my metaverse. I want you all for myself. And so trying to understand the real root of what was going on helped us understand whether or not we were missing out on something or not. And so we've done a little similar thing with using Midjourney, and Midjourney to some degree, ChatGPT. And I realized that it's actually, while it's wonderfully able to give you things, it is extremely limited in ability to actually design anything.
Yeah.
So you can't really, I mean, at this point, we're not using other augmented things, or we're not using Stable Diffusion, or we're not doing other things to carry it into another place. But so our tools, our traditional tools of SketchUp, Rhino, all of the sort of, 2D tools are really where we can still do design. You know, the ChatGPT thing, the way we've been using it is, as a designer, I feel like I'm much more of a visual person, and I've never been a good reader or a really good writer. I think I can communicate, but it takes me a long time. You know, for me to write a good page, it could take a day to do that. But I think that the thing is so there's a relationship between what I think I want to say and then the actual development of what I'm saying and my ability to put it in a way that's either cohesive, poetic, engaging. And I do find that just typing, and we've only used the free version of ChatGPT, which I assume is, it's kind of dumb, actually. I only say that it's dumb because I know what I'm trying to communicate, and it's not. Yeah,
it's like ChatGPT is on the other line right now saying he's dumb. Yeah. He just can't.
Yeah. He's dumb. These are great. What's
I
wrong?
I do use the paid one, and I have gotten to a point where I have overloaded it with context when I want something. Mm-hmm. It's a little more laborsome. But like, if I want it to create something, I will dump context and I'll be real sloppy. Like, I won't pay attention to spelling, grammar. I'm just kind of like,
oh, interesting.
You know, just, hey, I'm talking to these people. Here's my audience. I'm going to be in this town. It's going to be here. This is what I do. You know, this is what this is about. Here are some themes I was thinking about, but I really don't like these. Can you give me the, and like, I will literally voice to text all that. Okay. And then, it just kind of understands like the stuff that like I know, you know?
Yeah.
And then that's been helpful. And the more I use it, the more I realize I can be like really messy with my requests. I can be really sloppy, but the more it's almost the opposite of Google. Like the more I write, the better. Whereas in Google, it's like the more you write, the worse it becomes, you know?
That's an interesting comment, because what I found with Midjourney is that the simpler the statement, the more varied the results. Like the more detail that I put in, and that's also because the more detail I'm actually expecting it to do something and it doesn't do it. And so from a purely ideation moment, there's a great strengthen that. And that's what I love about some of these tools. I think it can get you there faster if you're discerning and if you have good intent. And, you know, I think those are the biggest things, because I can't imagine if I didn't know what I wanted to do and I just typed in some things and I got it back and I thought, oh, this is great. I'll just turn this in. This would be it.
Yeah.
Like, you know, because I can imagine most people are kind of doing that.
Yeah. And then
saying, this is good enough.
To me, it feels like then AI is controlling our destiny. Like the only way we keep our destiny in our own hands is to be ultra creative and like high effort on our requests and prompts, you know?
And then critical of those.
Back. Yeah, totally. Critical. Yeah. It's almost like you take one's answer and you put it into the other ones. And you're like, hey, this is what ChatGPT said. What do you think about this? Like, what's wrong with this? We can pin them against each other.
Well,
you know, maybe that's a,
well, you
that's
know,
a
the,
whole
the,
novel. That's, like, you can create a war between two AIs. Oh, man.
That's definitely something. You know, the first time I was doing it, what I asked it to do was pretty simple, but then I was sharing it with some of my friends and they said, well, you know, these are nice, but they don't really sound like you. You know, they don't sound like what I would expect you to say. And that actually really was great to hear that.
Sure.
because then I could go back and go, yeah, well, okay, so what are these things that are me and how do I supplement? So I got something that I didn't expect along with what I wanted much faster.
Yeah.
But I'm not writing longer things, but you know, but I think that it's a great tool for that. I can't imagine what a writer must go through.
Oh my gosh.
To write a novel over 3 years or something like that, or, you know, creating a story. It's pretty amazing.
It is. It is. Gosh, you know, with maybe that's how NFTs will resurface, is the authentication process of human made content.
Yeah.
You know, like 100% human made content would be interesting. Yeah. Or maybe people won't care about that. I don't know. A lot to think about.
Yeah. I don't know. Yeah, there is. But I mean, in terms of how it's moving design forward, I think that the one mistake we can make as designers is not be aware of how to use this and why to use it. Because I think, and I've always thought this, you know, developers, contractors, major corporations, you know, people like Amazon or Sony or Samsung, they have a much bigger vision of how they want to use these things. And they're not necessarily about design or improving people's lives at all, but about selling you the whole enchilada. And I do think there are going to be a lot of companies that will try to do that, that will try to own so many spaces, whether it's real estate and creativity and, you know, furnishings, that they'll figure out a way to, you know, put all that together and allow people to just, you know, pick and choose. So, you know, I don't think there's anything we can do to change that, but I do think that's probably a reality.
It is. And, you know, as you were speaking about it, I was like, you know what? There's room for everything, because, you know, Wendy's is fine. They make money and they serve a certain group of people. And then there's, you know, Olive Garden, and that serves it. And then there's, you know, a local, you know, place that's been, you know, people have fallen in love with. And so it's like, you know, they've all existed and we need all the food. So,
yeah.
So it's like,
yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. There's a place. Yeah, right. And you know, whether everybody's very big or very small, maybe that's where that place is.
I'm going to take a little turn in this conversation. I want to get into curiosity. I'm going to start with one specific question. If your curiosity has ever driven you into an unexpected innovation or an unexpected moment.
You know, through the process of doing design, there have been some moments where I really did not have any idea that what I thought about or what I drew could be built. And, you know, a lot of this was, you know, working with artists and working with artisans. If I had not opened up the possibility, like, you know, we built this one piece in Grand Rapids, which you may have seen, which is this object over a stairwell. And it was a big object. It was maybe like 70, 80 feet long. And we didn't know what it was going to be made out of, but it was very much like a stent. It was a web, parametric design. And we started talking to a guy who made boats. But if we had not been open to like all the possibilities of understanding manufacturing and scale, and this was totally dissimilarity. You know, when we were talking to this guy, he was kind of looking at us, and we showed these pictures, and then he finally goes, God, you know, I totally can build this. He goes, this is exactly what I can do. I've never done anything like this, but I can totally build this. It was a father and son operation, and we trusted them a lot to do that. So, I mean, I think that what that made me realize too was that sometimes you just have to have a little bit of patience and ask questions. And if you ask them to enough different people, things start to emerge. So for me, the aspect of curiosity is, you know, because it all comes back to me when you and I first talked, I was trying to think about, well, you know, where's the optimism in my life? Where's the place that I think that's going to, despite everything that's happening and
there are moments when you feel like you're getting left behind, or, you know, that you're not relevant anymore. And I realized for me, it was, well, that's, it's that, if that, that curiosity always feeds my creativity. Mm. So being in an open, being able to be open to something always leads to other open doors, I think. And that's been my experience.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Just when you were speaking about, you know, oh, well, will I be relevant and all this? I almost feel like there's like a V, and if you are curious and you are open-minded, as you described, then you go one way as you get older. And then if you are kind of closed-minded and less curious as you age, I think you go the other way. You actually probably do become less relevant. You know, things that you, the way it's always been done or whatever, becomes less relevant over time. That's natural. But I actually feel like I have become more curious over time. You know, I have, and I think that might be the most important skill right now. You know?
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, you can, it doesn't matter. It's almost like it doesn't even matter how old or young or experienced you are. If you're not curious and ready to learn, that you only have a 5-year window anyway, you know, you have to evolve.
Well, the other one that I found really important is, you know, having friends who are older and younger than you. You know, I have an amazing group of people that I can interact with that are in their 80s, that are not, you know, my parents or anything like that, but they're what you've seen. And gosh, you can imagine, you know, from their transitions, you almost feel like, God, you're in the Stone Age compared, you know, where when we grew up, which was not so far in the Stone Age, right? And I think it's always great to see that enthusiasm and that curiosity in them, and that's been inspiring for me because it keeps them alive.
Oh yeah,
you know, like this idea, we're going to do this, we're going to go there, I want to see that. And they'll do what it takes to keep their body in good shape and take care of themselves and to be able to have those experiences. And I think that's that, between that physical and digital, having real experiences is incredibly important. I mean, I know you can have fun with your friends on the internet and play games, but being in the world makes a huge difference.
It does. It does.
Yeah.
Gosh, you know,
there was another moment that I want to make. It's my Vienna Boys Choir moment, where this sort of thing would, I was in Vienna over Christmas by myself. And I said, you know, why don't I go see the Vienna Boys Choir on Christmas morning? That could be kind of cool.
Yeah.
Right. And so I go in there and I go, I'm sure I can scalp a ticket. And, you know, I'm a student, so I don't have very much money, and I'm kind of standing around, and this guy's, and sure enough, you know, the tour buses show up, they have a bunch of extra tickets, and they're like, you want to buy a ticket? And I bought a ticket, and I'm standing in line, and I get in, and my seat is right behind a column. Oh. I mean, literally my legs are straddling a column. And I'm thinking to myself, was this like the worst decision I've ever made to come see the Vienna Boys Choir, to sit? Like, I'm almost feel like I'm being punished. You know, that I'm sitting in right in front of a column. And it's like, well, that's why you sold me the ticket. Maybe, I don't know if there's any way you could tell. But I don't know if you've ever been to that performance, but it's in an incredibly narrow chapel. So the chapel is maybe 3-4 stories high. And I was on the very top floor. And you can't even see the people on the ground floor.
Wow.
And I couldn't see anything because I was looking at the column. But what I didn't know was, when they started the concert, the boys are actually on the top floor. So I just turned my head and I had a perfect view of the choir.
Oh, wow. That's wild.
Yeah. And so I went, oh my God, this went from the worst day of my life to the best day of my life, because no one else on below ever saw the choir. They only heard them.
Huh.
And so, you know, I thought, oh, that taught me a great lesson. That taught me a lesson about discomfort and not knowing, you know, am I going to get ripped off? And then, of course, you get in there and you're like, oh, I got ripped off. And then it changed in a second.
Wow. What a wave of feelings. That's actually it's super interesting.
Yeah.
Because the opposite could have happened. You could have been on the bottom floor, front row, you know, and you'd have been like, I made it. Oh my God, what a steal. You know?
It's like, where's the choir? It's like, it's a recording, or, you know, I would have never seen them. So, wow. You know, when those things lead to other things, and I think that's, I think there's been a lot of moments in my life that are like that. So, but if you're not willing to, you know, have it be a mess or failure, then it doesn't happen. Then nothing happens.
Yeah. And it's just, there's a little bit of irony in that the obstacle was a column, which, you know.
Yeah, as an architect, you're like, this is the worst seat in the house. This is absolutely the worst.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, there is a little bit of irony there. I mean, that's so cool. Wow, what a great story. That's really cool. This is fantastic. Is there something missed that you were hoping I'd ask?
I mean, I the future of design is really, it's nebulous to me, you know. But I also, you know, I went to a lighting opening last night, and it was with Floss Lighting. And I was just so excited to see that they were still pursuing this idea of craft and, you know, the sort of ambience of lighting and illumination and artists being artistic. And because they're an Italian company, that's very natural for them, you know, that sort of life and work is always really, really mixed together. It's sort of like eating food, you know, that passion is there in designs. And it was a great reminder of me that said, not everything has to be completely purposeful. It doesn't have to be successful. It is a journey. It's a process. It's an object that someone made in this period of time, and it may influence other objects, but it exists, and people honor that craft. You know, and it's harder when the scale jumps up, when you're doing big spaces and you're doing buildings. It's a little easier to see in objects and in art.
Yeah.
But it made me realize, like, yeah, that's still great. That's still something that reminds me that these small things that people do with their hands and their minds, or big things with their minds, make all the difference.
I love that reminder. And I mean, it just makes me wonder, what about the opposite? Like, what if, could you imagine what this world would look like or be like if anything that was ever made had to be purposeful and had to be, you know, like, important? And, like, I mean, what would this place look like? It would be terribly different.
Yeah, not,
like,
very fun. Yeah.
So it is like that is maybe the best thing about humanity is this collection of oddness and things that don't make sense. You know, like, that is the difference between us and the machines.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. And then, having it touch us and move us in other places. Yep.
Absolutely. I love it. So that journey was so well described there. That is the journey.
I hope so. I mean, I'm thinking that's the right way to go.
Yeah.
I'll let you know.
If it's not,
months.
Then designers are going to be basically like accountants. You know, I mean, it's just nothing against accountants.
You have to find
them
way.
Too.
But, yeah.
This was great, Joey. Thanks for joining me. For more design stories, visit us at ofs.com/imagineaplace. From OFS, I'm Doug Shapiro. Thanks for listening.